You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, the new head of Wisconsin State Parks shares some of his goals for the department. That's coming up next. Now, after 20 years of war in Afghanistan and trying to shore up the country against the Taliban, the U.S. left the country, which then fell to the Taliban in a number of days. Over the last few days, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has fled the country and Afghan citizens, fearful of a return to the Taliban rule that marked the years before 2001, have sought an escape through Kabul's international airport. President Biden defended the decision to withdraw in a speech yesterday, saying the United States had achieved the goals it set after the September 11th terrorist attacks, namely to prevent al-Qaeda from using the country as a base for more terrorist attacks. We're talking about the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and the harrowing scenes we've seen in the days following it, and we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the news? Do you think the United States did everything right, or do you think things should have been done differently? What should the U.S. do now that the Taliban has taken over control of the country? We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Nazneen Barma is Director of the Scrivener Institute for Public Policy and an Associate Professor of International Studies at the University of Denver. Nazneen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for inviting me to join the conversation, JC.
So let's just, this is how I want to start the conversation. What has been your reaction as someone who is a scholar who studies this to what we've seen over the last few days?
I think a combination of disbelief and despair, to put it starkly. I actually had the opportunity to be in Afghanistan myself in the summer of 2002 for a short time, a few weeks, conducting research there and working at the very beginnings of the international intervention there. And I think the fact that we could have ended up here 20 years later, if you had asked me then, I would have thought impossible. But I think in another way, the writing has really been on the wall. I think, unfortunately, things could have gone much better in the end game, even as we saw it coming.
Can you talk about some of that writing on the wall that kind of led us to here?
You know, so as you just mentioned in your intro, JC, the international community has been, and the American military has been working in Afghanistan to rebuild the state, rebuild the nation over the last 20 years since the United States and the Afghan Northern Alliance successfully defeated the Taliban in December of 2001 after the September 11th attacks. And it was a massive, it has been a massive operation over the last couple of decades, you know, trillions of dollars spent, obviously, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of American and allied forces on Americans, on Afghan soil. And I think, in some ways, the intervention has had its ups and downs. But I think over the last 10 years or so, the Taliban has been making steady gains across the country. And in as much as we've been getting, you know, I think rosy messages out of the administration, out of successive administrations, things have been going badly there for quite some time. And so I think analysts of Afghanistan are not terribly surprised by the outcome, but I think we are surprised, as you noted, by the speed at which this has occurred.
Yeah, because it feels like maybe even just a week ago, President Biden had said, you're not going to see the scenes that we saw in Saigon in Kabul. And then that's what we saw. What has been kind of the reaction there?
Oh, that's right. I mean, really sort of shocking in terms of, again, the pace at which it has happened. I remember kind of watching the news on Saturday, thinking I'm going to wake up on Sunday morning, seeing that Kabul has fallen to the Taliban, and that is indeed what's happened. And I think there's a combination, a sort of weird juxtaposition of an eerie calm in Kabul itself, in the capital city, where people are kind of shuttered up and staying indoors, and the Taliban soldiers are kind of patrolling the city, but there's very little sign that there is a battle per se happening. And on the other hand, these chaotic and really desperate scenes at the Kabul International Airport of Afghans trying to flee.
You know, President Biden has he's defended the decision to withdraw from the country, even though what we've seen over the last few days, maybe there could have been a stop put in place. Don't really know, but here's what he had to say about the decision.
There was only a cold reality of either following through on the agreement to withdraw our forces or escalating the conflict and sending thousands more American troops back into combat in Afghanistan, lurching into the third decade of conflict. I stand squarely behind my decision.
So Biden is pointing to the fact that this has been a four-president, close to a three-decade excursion in Afghanistan. You know, what might this have looked like had, you know, the next president come in? Could this have been something that we might have been there for a while?
I think that's right, JC. I think, you know, what something that sort of President Biden said in that speech that maybe got hidden by some of the other things and the reactions to the speech is that he made this kind of very clear statement that if we were to stay, we would be escalating. I think that there has been a fiction over the last 3 or 4 years that the 3,000 troop presence we have had in Afghanistan since President Trump, you know, authorized the first kind of major withdrawal, that that was an equilibrium, that was a stable situation in which if we just continued that troop presence, everything would kind of continue along. And I think that's false. I think the fact, again, is that the Taliban had been making enormous gains over the last 5 years and certainly over the last decade. And I think, you know, a couple of different things were going on the ground that you know, people weren't sort of necessarily recognizing, in particular, the fact that, the Taliban have been fighting and successfully kind of claiming territory. They've also had a massive campaign. They've been laying the groundwork for a decade and more of working with local tribal leaders, with civilian and military leaders. You know, there's an apocryphal saying where a Taliban official met a U.S. official at the peace talks and said, you have all the clocks and we have all the time. The Taliban has been biding its time, waiting for the United States to leave the country, knowing that that would happen eventually. And so I think that President Biden was absolutely correct in the assessment that were we to stay, it would require a ratcheting up on our part.
Our guest right now is Nazneen Barma. She is the director of the Scrivener Institute of Public Policy and an associate professor of international studies at the University of Denver. I want to go to one of our callers right now, Nazneen. We have Brad in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. I would like to say a whole lot. I'm a veteran of Desert Storm and the War on Terror. And I feel like what we should be doing right now is looking back at what we've done and holding people accountable. The United States had no right to go into Afghanistan, to bomb them, to overthrow them, appoint another government, have their government invite us in. It's all a bunch of crimes, and nobody's talking about that. I mean, yes, we got to, you know, stop the Taliban from hurting people if we can. But, you know, Afghanistan has sovereignty, and we need to honor that.
Brad, thank you so much for that call. Nazneen, what is your reaction to Brad's take here?
Brad, thank you for your service. I taught at the Naval Postgraduate School for 10 years, where many of my students were mid-career officers who had similarly served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And many of them, I think, shared your sentiment. The notion that you know, the question of what our goals were in going into Afghanistan in the first place in 2001, it's important to remember that we were, the American operation was in place in order to rout al-Qaeda as a reprisal to September 11th. And then there was a lot of, hesitancy about what the Bush administration at the time's aims were. I mean, Donald Rumsfeld, the then Secretary of Defense, sort of, you know, at the time said kind of precisely what Brad just suggested, which was that we should not be in the nation building business in Afghanistan and that the goal was to stabilize the country and to get out. And I think that what the question sort of really points to is that there were a series of goals in Afghanistan on the part of the American U.S. government, on the part of our international allies, and on the part of the Afghan government that we sort of put in place as a result of the intervention that were often contradictory. And those contradictions were never resolved over time. And some of those contradictions have resulted in, the crisis that we're seeing today.
Nazneen Barma is director of the Scrivener Institute of Public Policy and an associate professor of international studies at the University of Denver. She's with us to talk about what we're seeing in Afghanistan over the last few days as the United States begins to pull out of that country. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. The Afghanistan war has been in effect for about 20 years. What have you thought about it over those 20 years? What is your reaction to what we've been seeing over the last few days? What should the United States do next, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we will continue this conversation and take your calls right here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We continue our talk right now with Nazneen Barma about the end of the war in Afghanistan. She's the director of the Scrivener Institute of Public Policy and an associate professor of international studies at the University of Denver. You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Mike in Brookfield. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm kind of curious as to where the UN is on this. We've heard almost nothing from them. In a way, I'm kind of surprised that our administration didn't communicate with them that there may be some need for maybe some peacekeepers that could transition in and out or something like that. But it's been almost silent out of the United Nations.
Mike, thank you so much for that call. You know, international reaction and international participation here.
Absolutely. I think that's a really important point. You know, when Afghanistan, when the war first started in 2001, it was a partnership of the United States, its NATO allies, the forces, the allied forces that were in place in Afghanistan to maintain stability, were the ISAF, the International Stabilization Forces in Afghanistan. And I think what has sort of happened over the intervening 20 years is that much of the other elements of the international community have kind of splintered in some ways in terms of their relationship to the Afghan government. So what the UN has been much more involved in over the last 15 years, at least, is the sort of state building enterprise. So aid for public service delivery, aid for kind of building up the capacity of the Afghan government to deliver on its contract with the Afghan people. I think that the caller is exactly right to point out that it does appear that the administration has not or had not in the last couple of weeks and months communicated and as clearly with the remaining other international partners Afghanistan. And I think that, what I was reading this morning is that President Biden and Secretary Blinken have been making a lot of phone calls over the last couple of days, trying to kind of walk some of that back in terms of that miscommunication.
Thank you again for that call. I'm going back to our listeners right now. We have Jane in Manitowoc. Hi, Jane.
Hello. I happen to be an Army and Army Reserve retiree. I retired in 2004. But I do watch a lot of the news, and with this situation, there was no way to gracefully leave. And so no president wanted to be the one. They all ran on, we'll get the troops home. And then they got the news from the military leadership that when they got ready to leave, it would be a vacuum and that the Taliban would take over. And they all went, oh, well, that's not what we want to be responsible for. And with the last few years, Taliban going from village to village, buying up weapons and everything else for people that were hungry, people that needed money, it disarmed the citizenry. So there was no ability for even the citizens to stand up against the Taliban.
Jane, thank you so much for that call. Your reaction to what Jane had to say, Nazneen.
Thank you. I think, and Jane, thank you for your service. I think a couple of different things that I would sort of react to there. One is that, you know, President Biden campaigned on, as a number of other candidates did, on ending the forever war. And I actually, for what it's worth, I think that was the correct decision for all the reasons you noted and many more. This was A long drawn out endeavor on foreign soil where, you know, objectives have sort of gotten muddied and have been contradictory, as we were just discussing a few minutes ago. And I think, you know, many people agree that the time was right to pull out. I think we can separate out the question of whether withdrawing was the right policy decision, the right strategic decision, from the question of how it was handled sort of tactically on the ground over the last few weeks and months. And I think that, you know, the real anger that you're seeing and hearing from you know, politicians across the aisle, from veterans, from those who've served, is that things could have gone much better in terms of the implementation. The second thing I would just note is to amplify the point made that the Taliban have been working on winning over the population for a decade and more. And so when it comes to the time for the Afghan population, the defense and security forces, Afghan government to resist, the notion that they were going to put up a fight back, they had been worn down for many, many years in terms of their ability to put up a resistance.
Nazneen Barma is our guest right now, director of the Scribner Institute of Public Policy at the University of Denver. Now, Nazneen, we have seen some really harrowing video coming out of Kabul in particular, Afghan citizens really, really trying to, many of them trying to escape. How do you think we are in the coming weeks going to handle Afghan citizens that want to be resettled because they don't feel safe in Afghanistan right now?
JC, I think harrowing is exactly the right word. And as you noted at the very top of the segment, this was exactly what the Biden administration was hoping to avoid, these scenes that we've been all watching with horror. I think, you know, it's important to talk about what Afghan citizens are actually fleeing in terms of what the sort of Taliban governance program is. And, you know, I think there's still some question as to what we're going to actually see transpire in terms of what the Taliban's governance aims are. We all remember them as the sort of radical Islamist state. And I say Islamist because it was a political as well as a religious program that was in control of Kabul, if not the entire country, from 1996 to 2001, where we saw public stonings, public executions for people who were not following their program, the banning of women and girls in public spaces, the banning of girls in schools, the persecution of religious minorities like the Shia Hazara in the center of the country. Many of us will remember the horrifying destruction of the great Buddhas at Bamiyan. And so the notion that here was this, you know, radical ideology kind of taking hold. And I think there's a question as to how much of that will be the case moving forward. So it seems to be the case right now that the Taliban are adopting a more conciliatory kind of, you know, trying to kind of, you know, appease in some sense the notion that they're going to kind of go back to the same policies, that they will be more welcoming of women in public spaces and girls in schools and so on and so forth. But this is a question of time, and we'll sort of see what transpires. And so I think, you know, the question of why people are trying to flee is really a question of their experiences of the past, more than 20 years ago, and their uncertainty and fear about what the future brings with the Taliban regime in power. And then, you know, the question that I think you're also asking is a question about sort of what is our moral culpability, our moral responsibility toward the people who fought with our troops, who offered support to the American intervention, to the various international organizations, and so on. And I think I share, you know, many people share the sentiment that we do owe, many Afghans something. And the question is sort of what, in terms of what we could be doing for them.
Well, then let's look domestically. Then we've heard that there are some places that are already ready to accept refugees. Wisconsin, we could see people arrive in Fort McCoy. But there you'll always have people say, no, they should stay. And you'll have other people on the other side say, yes, we owe them a safe haven. How do you see that conversation playing out over the next few weeks?
I think one thing that I've been really kind of amazed and comforted by is the sort of examples that you were just giving of people really kind of reaching out, to open their arms to refugees and kind of recognizing how desperate some of these situations are. I've heard, a number of veterans talking on public radio over the last few days about their translators, their drivers, people who are reaching out to them on their cell phones and via social media begging for some kind of assistance. And we've on the scholarly side, there are a number of Afghan scholars in the country who are kind of desperately trying to leave the country for their academic freedom and indeed for their very lives, fearing that things that they've said in the past are grounds enough for punishment. And I think this is where we as American citizens and residents of this country can call on our representatives to demand that some of these Afghans are indeed brought into the country. And there are obviously sort of legal implications in terms of bringing people on in under these special immigrant visas that we've heard so much about over the last few days, in which there is a big processing backlog. But there are other solutions being floated in terms of taking certain groups of people, Afghan refugees, to other safe haven countries and sort of guaranteeing safe passage, at least out of Afghanistan, before the questions of resettlement really kick in. It's going to be, fascinating, and I'm hopeful about the conversation that might unfold on the American political scene about this.
We only have about a minute left. What will you be watching for? We've talked about refugees, but what will you be looking at maybe politically or on the international stage over the next few weeks as well?
I think one of the things that I'll be watching, looking at, is the ways in which the Biden administration sort of, now that it has in some ways admitted that it had not planned adequately for this, the speed that we've been talking about kind of caught the administration by surprise, how it will try to pick up the pieces and move forward on some of these very difficult issues, in particular on the question of Afghan refugee settlement and leaving some semblance of stability behind. The other thing I would just note very quickly is there still remains the question of whether there is a political to be made with the Taliban. The U.S. has a peace deal with the Taliban. There is a question of what the domestic political settlement in Afghanistan could look like. That's still a very live question.
Nazneen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, JC.
Nazneen Barma is the director of the Scribner Institute of Public Policy and an associate professor of international studies at the University of Denver. She talked with us about the end of the war in Afghanistan and what we've been seeing from Afghanistan, from Kabul, over the last few days. Now, coming up, we will be talking to the new head of the Wisconsin State Park System, so stay with us. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us. Now, if you've been to one of Wisconsin's 49 state parks this year, you're in good company. The DNR reports 2021 has already seen nearly a 20% increase in visits over the last year. And now there's a new fresh face leading the parks into the future. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you love about Wisconsin state parks or the boat launches, state forests or biking trails? What are some of your favorite parks to visit? And how long have you been going to the state parks? Maybe you're new to the parks or maybe you've been going for years. And of course, if you have any questions for the new parks director, call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Steve Schmelzer is director of the Bureau of Parks and Recreation Management for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and the DNR announced earlier this month that he took the helm in July. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on and giving me the opportunity to talk to folks on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about your history with the state parks. How did you get started?
You know, I went to school at UW-Madison and knew that I wanted to, when I was getting close to graduating, working in state parks. And then I applied at some properties around the state, Peninsula and Gov Dodge and Devil's Lake, and landed at Devil's Lake in 1992 and stayed there through a progression of jobs up to a permanent park ranger to a assistant superintendent and the superintendent, and spent 27 years there. So that was a really great opportunity. And then I promoted to a Southwest District Park Supervisor in 2020. And then the director position just a little less than a month ago. So it's been a great opportunity, and I've really enjoyed working at the state properties and working in state parks over the past almost 29 years.
Now, state parks, they evolve over time and they change. And you said that you have worked with Devil's Lake State Park. Can you talk about how Devil's Lake has changed over the, 20 to 30 years that you've been able to work there?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Devil's Lake, some of the significant changes that we've seen is, as the popularity of state parks in particular and all state properties has grown, Devil's Lake has been no stranger to that. From when I started the Devil's Lake until most recently, visitation probably has just about doubled, the times when we had, some busy weekends throughout the summer have kind of turned in now to, just about every weekend, they're at capacity and visitors are still streaming in. So it's, we've seen a lot of that. I've also noticed our visitors, we've had a much more diversity in our visitors. If you were to go there on a busy holiday weekend now, you might hear four or five or six different languages being spoken if you walk through the picnic area or walk out on a trail. So that's significant too. I think just the new visitors that are coming to the properties and coming to visit the properties for a lot of different reasons, really has been a change over the time that I've been at Devil's Lake and been with the program and the system. So it's a great change, some of the other things that have been significant, obviously, as we, technology has been a big factor, where people are being much more engaged in technology. And so, current conditions and wanting to have the most up-to-date information and being able to reserve a campsite on their phone and do all those kind of things. So it's been, a lot of changes that way, and we continue to change.
We are talking to Steve Schmelzer right now, the new director of the Bureau of Parks and Recreation Management for the Wisconsin DNR. And Steve, you just mentioned camping, which, is very, very popular in Wisconsin. And we had Chris Collin from Madison. They couldn't stay on the line, but they wanted to express some frustration that it feels as though it's impossible to book campsites because they fill up so early. Is that something that, one, is on your radar and something that you are all trying to address?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I look at our the number of camping nights that we've increased, even in the past 2 years, we have a 30% increase in the past 2 years of number of campsites that have been occupied. That's pretty significant. And I have heard this. I hear it from my own friends and family. Like, oh, hey, now that you got that job, can you help us out? And we have over 5,000 campsites in the system, and for most weekends this summer, it's in high 90% occupancy. So people are just getting out and enjoying those campsites. So I know it's difficult to get those campsites. One of the things that I recommend to folks is that, hey, if you think I only camp at Devil's Lake, look at other options throughout the state. There's a lot of other different options besides our most popular properties, but also, it might mean that, you might have to come on a Thursday or a Wednesday or a Tuesday or something like that where there are vacancies there. And ultimately, we need to look at the system as a whole and see, okay, what can we do to match the need of the campers and our visitors? What does that mean as far as campsites and those kind of things? So yeah, we're definitely looking at possibilities for trying to accommodate some of those folks that they just want to come and camp.
I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Alicia in Madison. Hi, Alicia.
Hello. Just looking for a better understanding of the distinction between a state park and a state forest, please.
Steve, what's the difference?
Well, it's basically on the property designation. A lot in our program, we manage 15 state forests, and that includes both the northern and the southern forests. And so, when you go into those properties, it'll you know, a lot of those properties you go into and it looks exactly the same. It just comes on how the property was designated. So, you know, if you look at a lot of the attributes and the recreational opportunities, some of them are exactly the same. It just depends upon, you know, where they're located. You know, you all the way to the north, you've got the Northern Highland American Legion State Forest, you know, with a large tract of land and a large number of campsites and campgrounds. And, you know, we've got the Kettle Moraine Northern and Southern units down in the kind of the southeast part of the state. So you've got some all the way in between there. So it's a pretty big diversity, but they're very similar.
Now, as we talked about, there has been a pretty significant increase in visitations to these parks, in part because of the pandemic. How are you hoping the DNR and your department, you know, kind of rides that momentum heading into the post-pandemic years?
Yeah, I think what we need to do is we need to, you know, as far as these, you know, some of our brand new visitors that may not have visited state properties in the past. So engaging with those visitors and finding out exactly, you know, what are some of the attributes and what are some of the recreational opportunities that they're looking for, and then cater to those folks while also still recognizing that, you know, our traditional users and recognizing one of the things that they, you know, they come to state properties for. And if you talk to, you know, 10 different visitors, you're likely to get, you know, 10 different reasons why they come to state properties, whether it's for, you know, for exercise or they're, you know, coming to watch birds, or they're going for a hike, or they're fishing, you know, rock climbing, just any number of recreational activities. And you know, outdoor recreation has really exploded in the last few years with the pandemic. And, you know, if anybody can attest to, if they, you know, they go to try buy a bike or to buy a camper or anything like that, they're in short supply. And so, you know, I would anticipate that, you know, we're going to continue to see, you know, large number of outdoor recreational enthusiasts that are going to come to our properties. And I would expect that, you know, we have to take, you know, we have limited properties, limited resources. And so we have to evaluate continually, like, okay, what's the best thing that we can do for the vast majority of the users, understanding that, you know, we can't meet the need of everybody for every sort of recreational pursuit that they have.
We're talking to Steve Schmelzer right now, the new Wisconsin State Parks Director, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see change about the parks? You know, is there something that you think would be a benefit, or do you think maybe the park should get rid of some stuff? What is your experience maybe camping or biking around these parks? We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org, and we'll continue this conversation and take your calls in just a moment right here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We are continuing our conversation with Steve Schmelzer right now, the new director of state parks in Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the Wisconsin park system? What would you like to see change? And, you know, what are some of your favorite places to visit? Call in now, 800-642-1234. Now, we had a listener call in who couldn't stay on the line. Susan and Madison wanted to know, if someone only has a landline phone, how do they make a campsite reservation?
Yeah. So what they can do is they can call our reservation provider, Camas, and they can make a reservation over the phone that way. So, yeah, there's the opportunity to do that. Also, if it's, you know, in person, you know, they can also do a same day reservation if you come to a property. But we always recommend advanced reservations. And like I said, they can call the Camas number and they can make a reservation that way. So that's a great question.
Now, I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Dave in Toma. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. I'm curious if we're doing anything to manage our forests now. In the spring, we started out awfully dry, and I was kind of worried where I live. Are we doing anything to manage our forests so if we do have an extended drought, we don't end up with the same results they had out west?
Thank you, Dave, for that call. Steve, what do you say?
Yeah, we work closely with the Division of Forestry in the Department of Natural Resources. And I know I specifically have worked with forestry staff on doing some timber stand improvements at different state properties. And so basically what that involved is removing some of the dead and diseased trees from the property and focusing on, you know, more of sustainable forest production. And so, yeah, we work closely with our forestry partners and try to, you know, get some of those dead standing and some of those other trees out of there, as well as manage invasive species, you know, in those forests too. So there's quite a bit of work being done on our state forests and our state parks to better manage those forests.
Thank you for that call, Dave. Now I'm going to stick with our callers. We have Zoe in Madison. Hi, Zoe.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
My question has to do with security in the campgrounds. I'm a senior, and I camp alone, and I have done for many years. And one of the things that made me feel really comfortable camping alone was for a long time we would have rangers that would come through regularly checking to make sure the campground was secure, and it made me feel that I was pretty safe. But it's been quite a number of years now since I've seen a ranger in the campgrounds at all. And it makes me feel that it's not as secure. There's not much security or much regulation, that the rangers don't really know what's going on in the campgrounds. And I just wondered if there's any thoughts about bringing in more security or having those rangers more active and really keeping the campgrounds safer than they feel right now.
Zoe, thank you so much for that call. So, Steve, any issues with staffing right now at either campgrounds or throughout the parks?
Yeah, we have, you know, our law enforcement and security is handled by a combination of folks. So we have conservation wardens that do the primary law enforcement in our state properties. You know, that changed probably about 4 or 5 years ago. And so they have, they make a concerted effort to come through. You know, at our busier properties, they have specific, you know, shifts that they work. And whereas some of the other smaller properties, they come through, you know, as needed or, you know, when we think it's going to be busy. And then we also have our rangers that are still on staff, obviously. And while they don't have law enforcement credentials anymore, they still can, you know, they can come through and monitor things and check on folks. You know, one of the things that we also instituted in the last couple of years, there's also a statewide hotline where folks can call in if they see something that's going on that is, you know, a little suspicious or something like that. They can call that statewide hotline, and the local law enforcement conservation warden could be dispatched there. And in a case that, you know, they might not be in the area, then we work with our partners with the local police departments and also sheriff's departments, and they also help us out too. So it's a team effort, and we work together to provide that, you know, level of security and safety that our visitors have come to expect.
Now, Steve, you know, we had Jeff and Superior call in, couldn't stay on the line, but was curious about whether or not there are any plans in the works to help rehabilitate, you know, Patterson State Park, because it experienced some really severe storm damage about 2 or 3 years ago. Any updates on that park?
Yeah, I know that we've had a number of large storm events that, you know, hit a number of our northern properties in the last few years. And I know that some of those were significant FEMA events that we work with our partners in the federal government and help us with, you know, repairing and replacing, you know, structures or just cleaning up some, you know, downed trees and those kind of things. And I know at Patterson, they had some of that damage done. And I think it's an ongoing process where, you know, we have some of the stuff can be done more immediately, and some of the stuff takes a little bit longer to do. So, yeah, I know we continue to work on that across the state. You know, whenever we have, you know, storm damage that comes through, it might take us a little bit to kind of get things back to normal. And, you know, specifically as trees and those kind of things, it may take, you know, a number of years. You may lose a lot of large trees that take a long time to grow back too. So it's definitely a work in progress.
Thank you for that call, Jeff, and that question. We're talking to Steve Schmelzer right now, the new director of the Bureau of Parks and Recreation Management for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Now, Steve, you just took the helm about a month ago. What are some of your goals for the parks and park visitors during your tenure?
Yeah, so I have a number of things that we want to work on. We, you know, first and foremost, you know, our staff really do an outstanding job. They really, you know, put forth the extra effort and provide, you know, some great opportunities for our visitors and our customers when they come into the properties. And so, you know, when I took this job, one of the things that I tell folks all the time is I don't have all the answers, but I have some ideas, and you know, I want to listen to the ideas of what the staff are saying and what our customers are saying. And we do that by surveying folks when they come into the properties, as well as, you know, providing opportunities specifically at the properties and also via online that they can provide comments to. So as far as some of the things that, you know, I think I would like to see, again, embracing some of the technology and, you know, I know a lot of times when folks come to state properties, they may not necessarily be thinking about technology, but, you know, with obviously with smartphones and mapping and a lot of different things that you know, folks can take advantage of, there's a lot of things that, you know, if we look across the system in other states and other, you know, some county systems, they have provide some opportunities. So taking a look at some of those technological advances and building upon those, whether that's, you know, GIS mapping of our trails to enhance reservations for folks when they want to come and camp, or, you know, buying admission stickers online or with electronic kiosk, just providing folks with the opportunity to provide better customer service to them. While also, you know, we also have to take a look at, you know, protecting the resource. You know, as we continually evaluate, you know, different ways of doing that, whether that's, you know, periodically, you know, closing some campsites, you know, to allow them to readjust. But we also, you know, I talked earlier about, you know, making sure we have enough campsites for folks too. So kind of, you know, getting in that good spot of evaluating that, but also providing a good opportunity for folks when they come out to the properties. I talked a little bit about also engaging with, you know, with our customers, our diverse customers, you know, talking with them and seeing some of the things that they would like to see at our properties. You know, they may have different recreational interests and amenities that they're looking for. So talking with those folks and engaging with these different groups and finding out, okay, what are some of the things that they're interested in and they want to see at our state properties, and then matching the need up with some of those folks. And as, you know, as our society has become more urbanized, you know, we may have a lot of folks that, you know, frankly, may not have experience with camping or fishing or hunting or those kind of things. And so providing opportunities at our properties where maybe they can learn some of those things, whether it's, you know, pitching a tent or building a campfire or even, you know, going on a hike. So those are the kind of things that, you know, we have to look for those opportunities to engage with the customers and our visitors, and so that they can, you know, when they come to the properties, I kind of know what they're doing and, you know, we know what they're there for then.
We're getting a lot of questions about camping in particular, clearly very popular in Wisconsin. John in Green Bay wanted to know if you knew anything about why there aren't any electrical camper sites at the Northern Highlands American Legion State Forest.
Yeah, well, you know, electrical campsites come up quite a bit. You know, I know that our electrical campsites occupancy is much higher than our regular campsites. And, you know, even, you know, folks that are, you know, more traditionally, you know, tent campers, you know, even them, typically they might have a phone or they have a device that they want to, you know, be available in case, you know, somebody calls them or they want to listen to some music or, you know, to charge that up. So I know electrical campsites, we have a high demand for those, and we continually try to provide additional opportunities to electrify campsites across the state. So, you know, we look towards a plan for electrifying more campsites, and that potentially could mean up at the Northern Highland American Legion State Forest, as well as across the state. So So we're continually kind of evaluating those and where we can provide that additional amenity to our campers.
So we only have about 30 seconds left, Steve, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you have a favorite park in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, having spent 27 years at Devil's Lake, I would say that that's probably one of my favorites. But, you know, one of the great things about this job is I get to, you know, go around to all the properties, and there's still a few state parks that I have not been to and a few that, you know, I have been to in a number of years. And so that's one of the great things I can do is get out and interact with staff and visitors at the state properties across the state. So I don't know if I could specifically name one property, but I guess I like all the properties.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you and have a good night. I appreciate you having me on.
Steve Schmelzer is director of the Bureau of Parks and Recreation Management for Wisconsin's DNR. He's been in the job for about a month, and we talked to him about the parks today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Thank you so much for being with us today.